Bing West is a number one New York Times best-selling author who has spent almost 60 years on the various front lines of war, first as a Marine Corps grunt in Vietnam, then as an Assistant Secretary of Defense under President Reagan, before becoming one of our nation's foremost chroniclers of war. Now, with his latest, The Last Platoon, a novel of the Afghanistan War, his first novel in almost 20 years, he uses our ongoing war in Afghanistan as the backdrop to tell about war and its consequences. The novel is a gritty, visceral look at the consequences of war from a man who has been on the ground of this conflict for two decades and has seen it from all sides. It is a great pleasure to welcome Bing West to the roundtable this morning. Thank you very much for being with us. A pleasure to have you.
Thank you, Joe.
So there's a lot to start off here, but let me begin with why it has been 20 years and why it was ultimately this book that had you say, okay, I want to write these stories again.
Well, I had spent the last 20 years writing six books by embedding with our troops in Iraq and Afghanistan, going over, I don't know, 30 or 40 times, and always going out with the platoons. And, you know, I served under President Reagan as the Assistant Secretary of Defense, and I'm close with many of the generals, but it really began to get to me year after year after year in Afghanistan, where the mission to build a democratic nation in Afghanistan struck me as being nutty. I mean, it just didn't make sense. And every time I come back and I talk to the generals or something, you know, they'd always say, well, we can do a thing. We can do it. And finally, I thought, I'm just going to tell the story. But to tell the story without bias toward any individual, I said, I'll write a story that's an action story. It's about how you fight, but also hopefully would be a metaphor for how the heck did we spend 20 years butting our heads against the wall. And in order to do that, I tell the story from four different points of view. I tell it from the point of view of the Marines and the CIA on the ground doing the fighting. And then I switch back to the White House and the Secretary of Defense and the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs. And what were they doing? And what were they saying versus those on the ground? And then, you know, Joe, every fight, when you get into it, you get in to win. And it's a mystery story in a way, because you're betting your lives that you're better than the other side that's coming against you. And they're betting the same thing on their side. Right. And so I also go into what did the Taliban and the drug lords, how did they think they could beat us? And what were they thinking when they went on the battlefield? And finally, I get to, well, who was controlling them? And it was the drug lords and the officials in Pakistan. So I try to tell the story from four points of view so the reader can understand how mixed up we became over 20 years.
How stacked was the deck going into this mission that nation building was going to work?
I fought in Vietnam in different roles, but one of my roles was that I had a squad in a Vietnamese village of 5,000 Vietnamese, and there were 15 of us Marines. And we were using the farmers trying to fight against the Viet Cong guerrillas who were coming into the village every night. And so I had a background of what does it mean when you're really fighting with others, and what's the difference between fighting with somebody else alongside them and the political overlay at the top. I believe we actually could have won in Vietnam. That's a story for another day. But when I took that experience and went to Afghanistan, holy smokes, I said, it only took me, I'd say, my first year there to say, wait a minute, we're dealing with different tribes who are hurtling headlong into the 9th century. I mean, they're about 1,000 years behind us. And we're going to build a democratic nation. The whole thing from the start, I thought, was stacked against us. And what really got to me, Joe, over time, I was wondering, well, President Bush, I thought, was a very good man, George W. Bush. I knew his father. I didn't know the son, but I thought he had decent instincts, but he went too far in saying, we can give freedom and democracy to the Afghans because they're tribes. And I was wondering, well, why isn't somebody telling him, Mr. President, you can do this only if you're willing to stay there the way we did in South Korea for 70 years, 70 years, not one or two. And I thought the deck was always stacked against us, Joe.
You make this point in the novel, and I think it's a fascinating one, which is that in Vietnam, we were used to death. It was accepted, and it was perhaps even expected as a consequence of war. But in the intervening decades from Vietnam to Afghanistan, as technology took over, the tolerance that the American people had for that ultimate conquest, that ultimate consequence of dying for the service in the service to our nation, what happened?
Well, in the novel, I try to, because these are like my grandkids, you know, I know them quite well. And in the Marines, you know, generation after generation, I try to show when you go out on patrol what you're thinking. And then when you start to lose people, wow. What happens then is that people begin to wonder, is this all there is? And is there another side? Is there a God? Is there a heaven? And they get very, very confused about it, because over time we've made material wealth the measure of America instead of, if you will, spiritual strength and believing in one another. And none of these young men now that are going out there, It's not patriotism, because the country doesn't care anymore. It's what do they have in themselves, and what do their small unit leaders bring to it when they begin to die? Mm-hmm. And our entire country, if you look at now what we're doing with the pandemic, and not just our country, the entire world, the attitude toward death has become kind of like saying, well, death shouldn't happen. And holy smokes, there's no such thing as a one-sided war. So when you get to those points where it's yours that are dying, wow, I try in the book to show how they try to come to grips with that. And in the end, it all comes down to two things, and this is going to sound strange for a tough old Marine to be saying, but first it comes down to love. I've had several young men throughout my career who died when I've been there on the battlefield, and they generally, it's exsanguination. You begin to lose your blood and you begin to turn blue. And I've never heard anger at that point. It's always an effort to say, tell so-and-so I love them. And it's not anger. It's love. And that's a strange thing to say. And the other thing is, and I found out most Marines, they still out there, they believe that there is something more. They believe that there is a God, that there is another side to this. And that comes out only at that moment when they're looking at a dead comrade. And I don't want to dwell on this too long. I get into it in the book.
Sure.
But it's just a fact. And our country as a whole is kind of rejecting this. It's like a front page newspaper story. If one soldier is killed or something, well, you can't fight a war that way. I mean, we've become, it's like we all think we're going to live forever here on Earth. And that's kind of nutty.
My brother served as a Marine while President Reagan was Commander-in-Chief. You, as I mentioned in the introduction, you were an Assistant Secretary of Defense under President Reagan. How have things changed since that time?
You know, I was really lucky because it was much smaller then. I could actually go to the White House as an Assistant Secretary of Defense, and I'd be bringing a head of state, and there wouldn't be many people in the White House. There wouldn't be many people in the office when I went in to see President Reagan. It was amazing. It was much smaller. You knew everyone, and there was a camaraderie. And actually, I also knew the Speaker of the House, Tip O'Neill, who was Democrat. So you had an entirely, much more unified, is what I would say, Joe. And the attitude toward the Marines was, we need our tough guys out there, and everyone shared that. A lot of that now has become fragmented in a way that I don't think is healthy at all.
With President Trump most recently pulling 2,000 troops from Afghanistan, that was very last minute. And I'm curious as to what you make of that move, and also really to the ultimate question of what you believe President Biden, when he takes office, will need to do.
Well, we're stuck between the rock and the hard place, and I don't care who the president is. No one wants to stay there for 70 years, and the Afghan tribes are going to have to sort this out for themselves. We went into Afghanistan because of the terrorists who killed us on 9/11. We probably need to keep, in my judgment, about the level we have there now, that no one even knows what that level is or pays any attention to it. And that's pretty important. What I mean is, we have to continue to put these terrorists 6 feet under and not allow them to rejuvenate. And that requires a certain group of people that we have, Special Operations Forces and our pilots using air and everything we have, our advantages, to keep the pressure on them, keep killing them. That doesn't require a lot of people. And it doesn't require that we transform Afghanistan into a democracy. So I think you're probably going to see President Biden continue with about where we are. And if you say to me, well, where are we? I'm going to say, we don't even really know. It's just a couple of thousand people. They're all real specialists at what they do. And the terrorists are deadly afraid of them. And that's about where we should be. Just keep a focus on making sure that Al-Qaeda cannot resurrect.
In the very few moments that we have left, what happened last week to our nation's capital? As you've said, you've been around a long time and you've seen a lot, obviously. What do you make of that? And what do you make of what the role of the military should be? Maybe less so in what happened last week, but certainly as we look to the inauguration next week.
Very little, if anything. I see no role. Joe, I don't want to see our military mixed up in all that political stuff at all, period. And I think that the retired generals should not be talking so much about political matters. Keep our military as the military, so they will answer to any commander-in-chief. You never want a president to be sitting there with a tough decision to make and to look at a four-star and think, is this man, in a week or two going to retire, and then is he going to come out and criticize me or something? You never want to get our military so that whether they're retired or active duty, they're perceived as political people. Mm. So I don't want to see the military anywhere near any of this stuff.
But so the flip side, I understand that point of view very much. But the flip side of it is, when you have so many members of the of all of the living defense secretaries signing a letter saying, okay, we have to be really concerned here. The fact that takes place is in of itself concerning, isn't it? Because normally they wouldn't speak.
That I believe was correct to do, and I believe what they were saying in that letter was to everybody, including the president, hey, stay in your lane. There is a constitution here. And I think that was a very proper thing to do, very proper.
All right.
In the book itself, Joe, in The Last Platoon is a novel.
I have to say,
President
Bing, I apologize, but I'm being told that our governor is getting ready to give his state of the state address. So I need to vacate the airwaves. But I thank you very much for your time, and I wish you all the luck.
What'd
in the world.
What you think of the book?
I love the book. Great book.
All right, there you go.
All right.
Thanks, Joe.
Bing West, The Last Platoon. Governor Cuomo now.